And you're very welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Delighted to be joined by Wesley Donnellan and Bernard Jackman to go to all things rugby in the week that has just been. Gentlemen, you're welcome as always. I guess we'll start with the Pro 14. I don't want to spend too much time now as it is midway through the week. But Donald, the drama at the end in Clonetley and Parker Scarlets when young Healy comes on to kick the winning penalty. Obviously, he had a good bit of game time under his belt during that second half, and Munster did seem to improve a little bit. But overall, Munster's performance, they've been accused of being very sloppy and maybe getting away with one in Clonetley. Is that being a bit harsh, or where do you think Van Graan's head is at now?
No, I think that's spot on. I mean, in fact, I was quite critical about the performance myself in my own piece in the Examiner this morning. I find it hugely frustrating to watch Munster at the moment. You know, they have so much talent there, but yet they seem to play within themselves. Damien D'Alande was brought in at huge expense to allow Munster to play a different type of game, to play to their strengths, in my view, on the wing. You've the likes of Conway and Keith Earls have been playing outstanding for a long time now. Chris Farrell, it always amazed me. You go back to Joe Schmidt's time when he was brought into the Ireland squad. He always seemed to play at a level way above the what we'd seen him play for Munster. So there is quality there. It drives me bananas, I have to say, that Munster seem to wait until they're way behind or they're in trouble in games before they actually start playing. I mean, they were 14 points down with 11 minutes to go, and the whole tempo of the game changed. Against Leinster, the opening game, the brilliant match we had. Do you remember the first game back after lockdown, the Pro 14 game? Munster were 11 points down, I think, with 15 minutes to go in that game. Earls and Conway came back, scored two great tries because Munster started to put a bit of width on their game. I must say I find it incredible to see you have that midfield partnership there. I think Farrell touched the ball once in the opening half. D'Alande, first time he got the ball was, you know, from that counter-attack when Scarlett had a very poor exit. Mike Haley did really well to set up a counter-attack, put away Andrew Conway. And D'Alande gives the scoring pass for Jack O'Donoghue. I just find it massively frustrating because I feel there's so much more within this group that we're not seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the general consensus as well. I share your frustrations watching it. Do you know what I was thinking back to Donald as well? Somebody who we met during the World Cup in Japan who would have loved to have worked with what Munster have, particularly at wideout right now, and tried to do it when he was there was Rob Penny, you know, spreading the ball around, just changing the Munster way of attacking the game. And I thought to myself, God, if that lad was there, is this something that's going to evolve, do you think? Do you think Van Graan ultimately wants to play a bit wider? Or is it just because Munster were throwing caution to the wind in Scarlets that they just were forced to play that way? There doesn't seem to be a game plan there at the moment. That's obvious anyway.
Yeah, well, look, I think South Africans, by their nature, they are a little bit more controlled. They like the physical element. They like the set piece. I mean, we saw something similar with when Razzie was there, albeit I think there was a bit more structure and a bit more of a willingness to play in certain parts of the field. But you go back to Rob Penny, I always felt Munster made a mistake when they left him go. We had a good chat with him in Japan. He's out there now. He's actually with the Waratahs in Super Rugby at the moment. I remember interviewing, you know, I think the problem was in his time, he went, Munster played one way for, going back into the amateur days. They won two Heineken Cups playing that way, but they had a pack. I think seven of the eight started for Ireland when they won the Grand Slam. So obviously there were strengths there. Then you had Striggerer and O'Gara who could, you know, pull the strings, put the forwards in the right areas of the field. I think when Penny came in, he's a Cantabrian. Canterbury played this way for a long time. He had a vision in terms of the way Munster play because the issue was, no matter how strong your pack is, when you get into the business end in Europe or even in the Pro 14, you're not going to bully opposition the likes of the French and the English pack. So therefore, you have to have another string to your bow. He probably went to the other extreme. Certainly, the fans in Thomond Park and Musgrave Park found it very difficult to have Paul O'Connell and Dunacaw Callaghan within touching distance on the out in the 5 metre tram lines. But he was making progress. And you go back, Munster got to two semi-finals. I always go back, Rogers' last game against Claremont, semi-final of the Heineken Cup. They were called back. They lost the game, I think, by 6 points. They were called back a forward pass from Paul O'Connell right at the death when they were in an attacking position, which is exactly what Penny was trying to develop and achieve. They could have won that game with a spectacular try in the end, but for a marginal forward pass. I remember interviewing Rob Penny the week he left. He'd been offered a one-year contract by Munster. He wanted a two-year. He wanted to finish the job. The guy was almost in tears because he saw this. You're not going to change a culture and an environment, you know, within 18 months. I think he was going down a path that would have benefited Munster in the long run. But look, history shows, to be fair, Erasmus came in and did a brilliant job in very difficult circumstances when you had the whole Anthony Foley scenario and the tragedy around his sad passing. But just when Erasmus was getting his teeth into it and making Munster a competitive animal, South Africa came calling. So Munster, like Penny was of their own making. Erasmus, you know, when your national team and your country calls for you, I think, and look, he went on, South Africa won the World Cup, so it was proved to be the right decision for him. But as I say, I just have this real sense of frustration because I think there's more within this Munster setup.
Yeah, they seem to have the tools, Bernard Jackman, there's no question. And in particular, you look at the potential of the back line now, the pace that they have and the handling skills, the centre partnership of Farrell and Dielendi should excite any club team in the world. But it just doesn't seem to be clicking at the moment. And look, it's very early days. We're into the first match of the season, so we don't want to be overly critical very early on. But it's almost a knock-on from last season, such as being the kind of truncated nature of things. Where do you think Munster need to go here? Like, what do you think needs to happen for Van Graan to get the best out of this squad?
Oh, look, I think it was surprising for me that they doubled down on that strategy they tried to implement against Leinster. I could understand why they did it against Leinster. Just didn't have the tools to do it or to be successful at it. But I would have thought, you know, first game of the season after disappointment of how poorly they played, they would have brought a lot more energy, a lot more ambition to that game against Scarlets. And to be honest, they're not even implementing the box kicking contestable game very well. They're not getting any returns out of it. So it's strange, to be honest. And you know, maybe that win and the nature of how they won it will give them a little bit more confidence. But like, going back to the team pre-Penny, okay, they didn't play wide game, but they, you know, it was very physical, it was very energetic, it was very collision based, and you know, they brought their backs into the game when the forwards had shortened the defence. Whereas now it just seems to be it's the last possible option to play with any width. So look, you'd have to imagine there's some really serious senior experienced players in that back line, and they must be tearing their hair out, you know, because their chances of not just winning with Munster but playing international rugby as well if all kicks all day. So I'd like to think that it'll start to evolve. I think Johan, you know, it's pretty clear that that's the game that Johan likes, but you know, you've got strong personalities in the coaching staff as well, and they need to have some more strings to their bow, because you know, they might even make the playoffs playing the level they played at the weekend, and particularly when the four South African teams come in. So, you know, Johan's in the last year of his contract. So the next couple of months are going to be really interesting to see how they evolve. But I think they have a squad that's far more talented than the way they're being set up to play.
Okay. Well, a huge reason why they might, before I come on to you, is why they might be able to get the most out of what they have outside would be their choice of 10. And I'm interested to know what you made of Healy's performance and equally what you made of JJ Hanrahan's performance. And again, we don't want to be too critical, but Hanrahan just hasn't done it at 10, Bernard. He has not ticked the box for Munster either half. He's had plenty of opportunities. He looked pretty horrific for that first half against the Scarlets at the weekend. We know that obviously Joey Carberry is out injured. We know there's been a problem position at 10 as a backup to Joey if he ever does come back. Is Healy the guy, do you think, that has the potential to take it forward? And has the Hanrahan experiment just not worked now? Can we just say that?
Well, look, going into last weekend, I think Healy's been a guy I've been impressed with when I've seen him play. I actually think Crowley might have the most talent there, but he's obviously a little bit behind. And look, we can't, if we're saying that Munster needs to blood young players, you know, it's probably Healy deserves a shot at it, and particularly the clutch quality he showed at the weekend is definitely shows maybe he has big game temperament and will deserve more cracks at it. JJ, unfortunately, looked like he's struggling a little bit for confidence, and he definitely is a confidence player. So, Healy probably deserves to see more game time. As I said, I do think Crowley is talented. I know the Munster coaches have huge hopes for him, and he was potentially seen as the best of those three young tens, the Healy, Flannery, Crowley. But look, just give them game time, give them opportunities, give them a game plan that's going to excite them and let them express themselves. And, you know, I saw Gordon Darcy wrote an article this morning in the Times talking about 50 caps. I don't think you need 50 caps to know if they're good enough. I would say, you know, 20 would be should be more than enough for any young player to show that they have the ability. But definitely give them game time over the next while and see what they're made of.
Whereas I have real problems with out halves who need confidence to play the game of rugby, because like they are the ones who should be out there directing the traffic, saying, right, give me the ball, let's get the best out of it. And as Bernard rightly says, JJ Hanneman just doesn't seem that type of player. When things aren't going well, he's not one to stick up his hand and kind of change things around. He needs kind of top of the game rugby, needs his pack to be going forward to get the best out of him. And even at that, you wonder where is his best. I mean, do they just need to look elsewhere now for an out half? Whether that's Crowley, Corcoran was brilliant at the 20s last year, whether it's Healy or somebody else, is the Hanneman experiment done, do you think?
I'd agree with Bernard that the from the bits I've seen, which is probably limited to a handful of 20s games, a handful of A games and a handful of club games, I think Healy possibly doesn't have the X factor that Crowley has, certainly in terms of taking players on. But he does have that temperament, obviously, and he doesn't shy away from taking responsibility. So they're both pretty promising. And at this point, I probably would go with Healy this week. I don't think it's that much of a gamble to put him in against Edinburgh. I think it's not just, like we've been talking about them changing the way they play a bit and bringing in young players kind of in terms of developing, but I think it's not even in terms of developing at this point. I think it's actually their best chance of getting results, because some of the more experienced senior players, some of the big names, look absolutely jaded at the minute. And I mean, the celebrations at the end told a different story, but they seem quite dissatisfied with the way they're going about playing as well. And I think the younger players and the combination of the younger players and maybe throwing caution to the wind a little bit in the last 10 minutes certainly brought a huge jolt of energy. And that's an energy they should be looking to build on even gradually now over the next few weeks. But going back to Donald's point about, you know, the way Johan might want to play, we might be kidding ourselves that this is part of the plan that they're looking to evolve the way they play. I think the side...
Yeah, because on Sunday, like the players seem to take ownership of what they wanted to do in the last 15 minutes, despite the game plan they'd be given, because the first 60 minutes was horrendous to watch. I mean, if we're being honest. And it looked like the players have said, right, well, screw it. We're gonna go out on our feet here. Or at least we're going to try something. And they took it on themselves. Didn't look like it was any direction from the coaching box, per se.
It seemed that way, and the bench definitely gave a big impact, and they were mostly young guys. It wasn't just Healy, it was Gavin Coombs, it was Fineen Witcherly. Kevin O'Byrne even is a guy who's playing way better this season than he has done in previous years, it seems. But I just, when in press conferences and stuff, when they've been interrogated about the tactics they employed against Leinster, to me there seems to still be a kind of trust that was the right thing to do and that was the right way to play and that's how you win games, and the execution was the problem. So we might be holding our breath here waiting for something that's just not going to happen, I think.
Well, you go back to that point, Wes. I mean, there's no doubt Saracens, before they played Leinster in the quarterfinal of Europe, they looked at that Munster game, the narrow 26-24 one, and the way Munster played. They adapted the exact same approach, but they just executed everything so much better. They controlled where the game was played. They kept Leinster back in their own half of the field. They pressurized them in the set piece. They built their game from there. That's exactly. And their kicking game was so much more superior to what Munster's was. So therefore, I think Birch alluded to a while ago, there was nothing really wrong in the approach in terms of how you go about beating Leinster. It was they didn't have the skill set to execute it, whereas Saracens did. Now, in terms of what's down the line, and we've spoken, look, we're blue in the face talking about this. The bottom line here, there's no doubt that the younger guys who did come in all added something, but they were chasing the game. You're 14 points down. You've no you've no option but to throw caution to the wind and have a go. And the Chris Farrell try, 68 minutes, I think that was the first time he touched the ball in the second half. But you look at what Munster have coming up over the next 6 weeks while a lot of the players are away in Irish duty. They're playing Cardiff Blues, Dragons, Benetton, Ospreys, Glasgow and Zebra. Now, of those, Glasgow are the only team who've actually won the tournament in the past 3 or 4 years, and the rest of them have been pretty average. So therefore, you shouldn't have any fear in terms of investing in these young fellas, as long as you surround them with a key bit of experience. And that, for me, you look, that's what Leinster have done so successfully over the past 4 or 5 years. So look, there is an opportunity there now, and you know, Munster just have to kick on and avail of those opportunities. The young fellas have shown in the chances that they have got that they have the capacity to play.
I think, Donald, I think the one, like, a bit misunderstood maybe, but one that really grabbed people's attention was when there's so much excitement about Craig Casey and his first involvement. He takes a quick tap, makes some ground. He's busy bringing energy like we've seen him do with the Irish 20s and whatnot in the past. And then they take a line out hot off the top on the opposition 22 and he puts a box kick up into the air. I know at times Steph Evans is going to drift out of that position on the wing and maybe there's space there, but the fact is he didn't in this case and they were just too programmed to adjust.
I think that was when people
put their head and hands at.
Yeah, you go back to that very point. I mean, I spoke to a Munster player about this because it was driving me bananas as well. But you go back, I think Edinburgh, the quarterfinal that they scraped to beat Edinburgh in Murrayfield a couple of years ago. Conor Murray, there was a similar opportunity when the winger has moved in into the 15-metre channel and there was space there. Munster ended up either scoring or creating a scoring opportunity from that. So that's all well and good. But you've got to scan and see who's there. Peter Romani, I think, might have been... I'm not sure whether he was on the field or not at that stage. But the bottom line is, Steph Evans was standing in the 5-metre channel. He ended up... And he's only about 5'8" or 9". He's certainly not one of the biggest wingers in the world. But Andrew Conway, who is superb in chasing those kicks, he really had no chance of regaining that. But you look at Craig Casey, I mean, we've seen him at under 20 level and the guy is just so full of energy and so full of enthusiasm, but he almost looks sterile in comparison to the player that we've seen at that level. He is another who has so much more to offer, you know, and you've got to give these guys their heads.
Jay, you're well placed to talk about Crowley as well, Donald. Obviously, we would have seen a lot in the 20s last year, but Carn as well. He seems to have that X factor that Wes mentioned, that Bernard mentioned as well. Is he the potential solution at 10 for Munster? Because they're crying out for an out half to take control of things.
The guy has talent, there's no question about that. But he also has the confidence that you need. The point that you made yourself earlier. And there's Ben Healy has that. I watched Ben Healy play for Glenstall when they won the Cup in Munster 2 years ago. 2018, I think it was. Glenstall had never won a Schools Cup in Munster. They had a good team, but they were playing... Christians in a final, obviously, they wouldn't have had the tradition. He was the 10, he was the place kicker, he was the captain, he was the star player. So everything was on his shoulders, but he delivered. So he has the temperament as well. So at some point, you've got to back these guys and trust them. Like JJ, he's a confidence player, there's no doubt about it. But if you look at the game, he just drifts deeper and deeper. Like, JJ is a guy who likes to play he likes to play flat, likes to take people on. We know he has a good passing game. We know he has played a lot at 12 and he's played at full back. So he has the skill set, but he did seem to retreat a little bit deeper as the game went on. And that is a confidence thing. So there's no doubt in my mind. Crowley has it. I think Ben Healy has it. I think there'll be there'll be an interesting battle going on, I think, in Munster and in between those over the next few years. You then look at Leinster. I mean, Johnny Sexton isn't going to go on forever. And you have the two Byrne brothers, Ross and Harry. People who know better than me, who've seen them more often, think Harry might be eventually better than Ross. So that's going to be an interesting dynamic in the Byrne household as that goes on. But there is young talent there. But look, there comes a point when you have to back them. And I think Munster have reached that point.
Brilliant. We'll move on to Connacht. It was a cracking game. I don't know how much you saw of it, if any, but against Glasgow, particularly the second half, plenty of tries there. But one player that stood out, he just looks in unbelievable condition, as has been pointed out for the last couple of months, is Bundy Aki. And in terms of the Ireland conversation now, I mean, it'd be very interesting to see what Andy Farrell decides to do with Robbie Henshaw not playing his best rugby at the moment. Bundy Aki flying it for Connacht. Can he transfer that to the Ireland setup? But he certainly is a man on form at the moment. Do you want to pick up that, Wes? Did you watch any of the game?
Yeah, he's been excellent since they came back from lockdown. Obviously, long before they even came back, people were, you know, pointing to his physique and the conditioning work he'd obviously done during that time. Just seems to have a huge amount of energy, you know, even when he's off the field there screaming encouragement. And yeah, to me, he's a shoo-in at the minute for 12 ahead of Henshaw.
Ahead of Henshaw,
yeah, I think so. And I think Gary Ringrow, as much as McCloskey and Farrell and a couple of others are playing well too, I think you couldn't look beyond Bundy and Ringrose for the starting midfield at the minute.
Okay, Donald, I mean, like, you know, I don't, again, Robbie Henshaw is a player that we've had so much expectation and hope for. I guess he's been a little bit of a victim of positional switches, whether that's a 12 or a 13 or even in that little experiment for against England at 15, which was ill-fated. But he, I guess nothing brings out the best in a player like a bit of competition, and he has serious competition with Bundy Aki for that Ireland 12 jersey now.
Yeah, he certainly has. I mean, it's well documented over the past number of years that the three of them, in other words, Henshaw, Aki and Gary Ringrose, have rarely been all available at the same time. Aki, I think, has only missed a couple of games since he was first capped, one of them after he got suspended during the World Cup. There's no doubt in my mind that if Farrell is starting where you reward form, well then, on the basis of that alone, it has to be Aki. There's also the whole energy that he brings and this infectiousness that he has in a group, which is hugely important, especially, you know, because like Ireland, they're not going to have a huge amount of time to prepare for this game. So it's a good challenge for Farrell to have. I mean, he's going to be sweating about a number of other positions, but the centre, when you add Chris Farrell into that and you add Tom Farrell, who I think every time I see him play for Connacht, he really impresses me. I know Joe Schmidt brought him into a squad a few years ago, but you look at that collective, you know, I've spoken before about Andy Friend. He really impresses me, but that backline in Connacht, when they're clicking, like Carty seems to be back to where he was pre-World Cup. Marmion is fighting hard for that number 9 jersey with Ireland. Juvaki and Farrell, as I say, he really impresses me. And, you know, they have a young back three and options there as well. So, look, it's one of the better problems that Farrell is going to have. He has so many injuries in other positions that he'd be scratching his head maybe in terms of, let's say, tight Eddie's issues there at the moment. But I think on merit, you have to go with Bundy at the moment.
And just, you know, on Andy Friend as well, Bernard, it's brilliant to see Connacht play the way they do. He spoke about Bundy Aki's try in the second half when Porch put him free, little grubber kick down the line. And Bundy Aki went and dove on the ball. But they said, look, this is what they work on, the transition from defence to attack, those little moments to recognise where there's space. And they executed that. I mean, it's almost the exact opposite of what Munster are doing at the moment.
I think in terms of all the four provinces, Connacht probably have the most ambition in terms of attack and play. They know they're not as big and powerful as some of the other teams. And they're very clear in how they want to play the game. And it was a great game. I mean, that was probably the game for me at the weekend. Glasgow are a team who set up to play as well. But I just think, you know, Connacht's transition and play, their skills are excellent. Carty's kicking game, attacking kicks, it keeps the backfield honest, and that opens up opportunities for the likes of Peter Sullivan and John Porch and Alex Wooten when they keep it in hand. And it's not an easy task. He doesn't have the depth of other teams, but when he can get the majority of his first team out, he does a great job with them, and no one would like to play them, particularly in the sports ground. So, and I think also he doesn't get too carried away with defeats as well. He's a real positive nature about him, and he's getting the best out of Bundy, and he's a real talisman for them. So, great find by Connacht, obviously, you know, after Keane, and he deserves a huge amount of credit.
Okay, well, let's move on to the wire.
I think it's worth, you know, when you're talking about confidence and, you know, players taking an opportunity or maybe being unfairly criticised. Alex Wooten, I think, is one that we should just give a shout to. I always rated him when he was playing for Munster. He had this great capacity to beat the first defender all the time and play. But he had a bad experience. Remember the semi-final against Racing? Yeah. I think Teddy Thomas got two tries against him. He got lacerated after that. And his confidence dipped. And he never really got another chance. I always felt he was worth another chance. No, it's difficult, obviously, because Conway and Earls were there. There's no question they were a step ahead of him. But I'm delighted to see a guy like that. And bear in mind, he's only gone to Connacht on loan. So obviously people in Munster see something in him still. But the fact that he's been handed a second chance, and in the games that he's played since the return from lockdown, he's been really impressive. And I just think it's great. There's a lesson there for all players now. I know he's about 25 or 26 now. But every player goes through ups and downs, loses confidence. But it just goes to show, if you work hard, you take your opportunity when it comes, you know, you don't throw in the towel. And I'm delighted to see him doing well, because I always thought he had something to offer.
And isn't it great, Wes, for someone like him to go to someone like Andy Friend, who we know, obviously, former Sevens Australia coach, with the talent that Connacht have, but knowing that Alex Wootton is going to be part of a backline when he does play, that's going to get his hands on the ball and develop. Like, he's not going to be sitting there ball watching or being asked to field high balls, and that's his some contribution to a match. He's actually going to get the chance to show what he can do, which is brilliant, I imagine, for him.
Yeah, and they've had injuries in the back three too. Like, I mean, you know, the Porch and, well, not Porch, but maybe Alex and Peter O'Sullivan mightn't have even necessarily started as much without a couple of other injuries. And I suppose, you know, you'd have to give credit to the people that appointed Friend. And I mean, obviously they had a little blip between Pat Lamb and Friend, but I mean, I suppose they identified coaches in Pat Lamb and Andy Friend that are these very positive guys that empower players to play and give them confidence, because, you know, with the greatest respect in the world to them, they don't necessarily have an abundance of talent more than some of the other provinces, but they're being backed and encouraged to play, and they're taking confidence from that. And I think, you know, whether it's a professional games board or Willie Ruan or whoever, someone needs to take credit for possibly identifying that was a trait in a coach that was particularly suited to Connacht and the particular challenges they face.
Okay, one last point. You know, my love affair with the All-Ireland League, just a nod to Peter Sullivan. I saw him play for Lansdowne on a number of occasions over the past few years. And, you know, you're at a club game, there's always one or two guys who stand out. And I always remember asking, who's this guy? What's his background? Because he impressed every time I saw Lansdowne play, he impressed. So again, Connacht have been probably better than most in terms of identifying talent that, for one reason or another, and, you know, when you look at every, you know, Sullivan is another Leinster product, and so many guys in their production line ahead of him. But again, Connacht have been brilliant in identifying guys who are a step above the rest of the All-Ireland League and giving them their opportunities. Well done to them.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a huge list of names as well that have been from Lansdowne to Connacht, which is kind of weird. Craig Ronaldson, you think of Sullivan, Kelleher. Anyway, look, we'll move on, lads, if we can. Bernard, I'm going to ask you this first off, because you might be best placed, just to give us an impression of where we're at, really, and how worried the unions might be with the financial position at the moment, COVID-related. We know we won't have crowds for the November internationals, and report today on the RTÉ website, which you can read from Mick Lennon, about the possible delay for the 2021 Six Nations, such as the worry that if we don't get crowds through the gates for the 2021 Six Nations, the unions will fall further behind. You know, Conor O'Shea is in with the RFU alongside Sue Day, trying to basically plug the gaps in terms of finances there. We know Philip Brown is on the record as saying, look, this is a serious, serious situation as to the future of the professional game here. If we don't get help, or we don't get crowds back in sooner rather than later, we are in real trouble. It does seem to be a picture being painted from all the unions, Wales as well, 4 million losses over the November series that, per game, that there's serious trouble down the road, Bernard, unless this can be addressed. But nobody knows how to address it, because we're at the whim of this virus.
The only way to address it is government handouts. I mean, apart from that, the game is in a very tricky situation. The RFU were in trouble pre-COVID. They'd overspent on the curriculum development. Their community game costs had got out of hand. They were trying to cost cut already. This is just completely, I suppose, exasperated. the four Welsh regions borrowed $5 million each on a term loan, and that's going to have to be paid back over the next 5 years. And, you know, that'll further reduce their budget, but it's only keeping them alive. Look, unless we get bums on seats, the international rugby is different than Premiership soccer, and international rugby feeds the professional game in Ireland, or in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and also feeds the community game. So, you know, we're much more reliant on actually people in the ground than I said, Premiership soccer, where it's a multi-jurisdiction TV deal. So I'm not surprised to see, you know, rumours of looking at the possibility of moving the Six Nations back, and not to miss the opportunity to get people into the crowd, into the stadiums. But again, you know, how far do you push it back? I mean, you know, when are we going to be able to have, you know, 40,000 people in the Viva or Twickenham? So it's a perilous state at the moment, and I just can't see how the game we know at the moment, and I said across all levels, club, community, professional, can stay the same without government aid.
Yeah, and it does seem to be at the moment they're pushing ahead with the completion of last year's Six Nations, because the prize money is so valuable to the unions that they just need that money to happen. So is it almost a trade-off here? Like, I mean, if they push the Six Nations back indefinitely, will it ever go ahead? Versus if we just play it without the crowds, at least we'll have the prize money. Is that literally as raw as it gets? Is that the decision that they have to make here?
Look, I can understand finishing off this Six Nations, getting prize money in, but I'm not sure the commercial background to it, but will the prize money be the same next year's Six Nations crowds? You know, so I'm sure everything is being analysed. The RFU are very lucky. We had a cash reserve, and they hit the cutbacks here haven't been as extreme as elsewhere, but there's going to come a day where, unless they can see, you know, guaranteed income streams coming in the future, that they're going to have to make hard calls. And it's a horrible situation for everyone involved.
It's a horrible situation.
I think at the moment, the RFU are hemorrhaging $5 million a month. That's what it's costing to keep the professional game between the provincial and the national setup going. I know, speaking to somebody within the RFU, when the suggestion came out on Sunday evening that we were going to level five, that would immediately, the two, you know, if that was for the next 4 weeks, then the two Six Nations games were gone from our point of view. That would have massive repercussions. As it is, like Philip Brown has, you know, he's talking between 20 and 30 million of losses, but they are scheduling a serious review in December. And if nothing changes, there will be further redundancies. Like, the RFU staff are down to 4 day week already. They have taken a 20% pay cut. So this has to impact on the playing staff pretty soon. So it's a very worrying scenario. And it's the same worldwide. I mean, Birch alluded to the fact that the RFU have been under pressure well before COVID. The Australians are hanging on by their toenails financially. New Zealand, generally, you know, they don't generate a huge amount of income themselves. You go back, we're actually gone from a feast to a famine, because it's only nine. At the start of the season, the RFU had that windfall from the sale of land in Newlands. That was about 28 million, 25 million net, I think, which they invested in buying their offices in Lansdowne Road. You had the CVC money from the Pro 14. But apparently the first divvy that they've got from CVC has been absorbed already in keeping the game afloat. So it literally is finger in the dike stuff. And I know people both within in Munster and Ireland, the financial pressure, that is the thing that's exercising everyone at the moment. We've been talking about Munster and the way they play and their tactical approach and what they should do. There's far more serious issues going on in the background. And that is exercising people who run the professional game every minute of every day.
And not to make light of it, I guess, Donald, CBC's position now in terms of their potential investment in the Six Nations and the international game, taking the club game aside for 1 second. I mean, are we at the stage now where the RFU and the unions are so flummoxed by their lack of cash and their financial downside that literally whatever CBC offer now, they are going to have to take? Is that strength of CBC's position?
Well, they have to be. they have to be strong. They have to be very clear here, because you can't throw out the crown jewels, something that you've built up over a long period of time. You can't just hand them away overnight. But it'll be interesting to see, because the Six Nations broadcasting rights are up at the end of this season. The Pro 14 television rights are up as well. So as we know, CVC, they have that 28% interest in Pro 14. They were on the verge prior to the COVID, the lockdown in March, of securing a shareholding of the Six Nations. I think it was around 16 or 17%. That was all put on hold as a consequence of what's happening. So I'd say they are in a much stronger position now. The next broadcasting deal that's done is going to have to generate huge money. The fact, I think, that, you know, we haven't spoken about it yet, that the four South African, the Super Rugby franchises are now confirmed. Well, South Africa have confirmed that they want them in. The participating unions now from Ireland, Scotland, Italy and Wales, they have to rubber stamp that, but I can guarantee you can take that as a given. So therefore, from a broadcast point of view, the South Africans, who were I think, contributing 68% of revenues to SANZAAR, from the club perspective, they're now shifting to Europe. So therefore, that must have a beneficial effect in terms of what the new broadcast right is going to be. But, you know, it can't come soon enough. No, but look, they're talking about having a vaccine maybe by the end of the year. So if you can ride the storm until the end of this season, to next May or next June, you know, you can't compromise what has been built in a professional sport, you know, because of what's happening over a 12-month period.
Well, in terms of South Africa then, does it look, Donal, increasingly likely that, you know, this new Six Nations broadcast deal with South Africa being, I guess, pushed towards the Pro 14 in terms of their top clubs, it all kind of feeds into this narrative that South Africa might well join the Six Nations sooner rather than later. And if that happens, financially, I imagine it's a lot more attractive for any broadcast partner to come in and be a part of a Six Nations tournament. For CBC as well, to add the South African element, it's more attractive as well. Is this a potential kind of sticking plaster to the whole thing?
It is, but it'll be interesting to see what happens then in Southern Hemisphere rugby. I mean, you know, in the longer term, I can't see how it's sustainable that the four big provinces in South Africa are playing club rugby in Europe, but international rugby in the Southern Hemisphere. That doesn't make any sense. But they're going to struggle in the Southern Hemisphere without South Africa to get a sustainable model. I mean, in Australia, I think Foxtel have pulled out of their domestic rugby at the moment. So they're struggling to get a broadcast right for the ARU, are struggling to get a meaningful broadcast television deal at the moment. Then you have Argentina left hanging out down in South America. Where do they fit into all this? So it's, I'd say from a world rugby perspective, the whole thing is a mess at the moment. But the pandemic has accelerated a process whereby South Africa wanted to get out of Southern Hemisphere rugby. It's accelerated it more than anybody could have thought. But it will be, as of now, South Africa are hoping to participate in the Rugby Championship, which has now been rescheduled to happen within Australia in November and December. But it'll be interesting to see. It could well be their last involvement in that tournament as well.
As you and I were talking yesterday about Australian rugby and where it's at the moment, and the answer is it's in a pretty horrific place. I mean, there's no interest in the game, really. It's taken a backseat to rugby league, to Australian Aussie rules football as well. It's cricket, you name it. It's just fallen way down the ranks. Then you have New Zealand, who seem, you know, as buoyant as ever, but financially, how do they make sense of a rugby union system that was really self-reliant? I mean, their best competition seems to be coming from within their own teams. How do they kind of market that and make that financial makes financial sense out of that? And if it seems to be the writing on the wall that South Africa do end up coming to the Six Nations, you're leaving Australia in a mess, New Zealand, who want to continue the standards that they've set, playing amongst themselves, and Argentina out in the wind. The whole thing is a bit of a disaster at the moment.
I can't see at all how New Zealand think, you know, going it alone, so to speak, with a country of 4 million people, as strong as that All Blacks brand is, I just can't see how there's any sustainability in that. I mean, if you wanted to get out the blue sky thinking, as people like to refer to it. You know, we're throwing all sorts of things out on the table. I'm sure people will laugh at the suggestion, but I mean, I'd say in Australia, they'd bite your hand off to be able to merge with league at this point. Far more popular, better athletes, or as good. You know, league has no global profile. I mean, if all bets are really off, maybe all sorts of things need to be looked at. I mean, I kind of disagree with Donal. I don't disagree with the principle, but I just don't think they're going to be in a position to turn down a cash injection from CBC, even if it is a little under the odds. And again, we're not public health experts. And Donal mentioned the WHO talking about a vaccine by the end of the year. But I think equally there's a consensus that there's a 3 to 6 month rollout with that, and it happens with gradual percentages of the population. So you might get to next summer and have 20 to 30% of the population inoculated, and that doesn't allow for a full stadium either. I think Philip Brown mentioned the need to have 18,000 people in the Aviva to make things feasible. I think you'll be doing well to have 18,000 people in the Aviva in November 2021. You know, and that's before you even come down to the real grassroots, and you kind of think the club and amateur game, just in this country I mentioned, but I think it's going to be absolutely destroyed by this. I mean, now people are just stopping with no prospect in sight of when they might return. Like, lots of people will just stop playing, will opt out. If cases go up, they won't want to take the safety risk, even if it did come back. I mean, yeah, I didn't quite agree with the severity of Philip Brown's language a couple of weeks ago, but I suppose overall it's an existential threat to the game as we know it, if not to the game entirely.
Hope you're enjoying the podcast and we're brightening up your week here on the RT Rugby podcast. Bert, you anything to add there before we all go off to the pub that we can't go shut to have the pint that we badly need?
No, look, I think the English clubs and the Welsh and the Scottish and Ulster to a certain extent were helped by the government subsidy with furlough. So maybe they're not in as bad a state as we are at the moment. But look, it's a very difficult task, and hopefully that vaccine comes in and we can see some positive light signs.
All right. Okay. On that note, gents, we'll leave it for this week. My thanks to Donald, to Bernard and to Wesley. Stay tuned and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. We'll talk next week, same time. Thanks very much for listening.